We're going to look at an event that is given to us by two of the writers of the Gospels, Matthew and Mark, the cursing of the fig tree. It's a very interesting event, and one that has given rise to some speculation of accusations against Jesus, and something that is a little bit difficult and confusing to understand. However, I think as we look at it in our study this morning, we'll come to a good understanding why Jesus cursed the fig tree and why he was justified in doing so, and hopefully then we can gain some lessons that from the way that Jesus did this, and the purpose and the timing of it will be something that we can benefit from as we look at this. We're going to begin by reading the text. We have actually three texts. We're going to look at Mark chapter 11, verses 12 through 26 first. "And on the morrow, when they were came from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree afar off, having leaves, he came, if haply he might find anything thereon. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. And Jesus answered and said unto it, No man eat fruit on thee hereafter forever. And his disciples heard it. And they come to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple, and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple, overthrew the tables of the money changers, and the seats of them that sold doves, and would not suffer that any man should carry any vessel through the temple. And he taught, saying unto them, Is it not written, My house shall be called of all nations the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves. And the scribes and chief priests heard it, and saw how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people was astonished at his doctrine. And when even was come, he went out of the city. And in the morning as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, calling to remembrance, saith unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which thou cursedst is withered away. And Jesus answering saith unto them, Have faith in God. For verily I say unto you, that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, Be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, and shall not have doubt in his heart, but shall believe that these things which he saith shall come to pass, he shall have whatsoever he saith. Therefore I say unto you, What things soever ye desire, when ye pray, believe that ye receive them, and ye shall have them. And when ye stand praying, forgive, if ye have aught against any, that your Father also which is in heaven may forgive you your trespasses. But if ye do not forgive, neither will your Father which is in heaven forgive your trespasses." Now let's look at Matthew chapter 21, verses 18 through 22, a much condensed version of the same event. "Now in the morning he returned into the city. He hungered. And when he saw a fig tree in the way, he came to it and found nothing thereon but leaves only. And said unto it, Let no fruit grow on thee henceforth forever. And presently the fig tree withered away. And when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, How soon is the fig tree withered away? Jesus answered and said unto them, Verily I say unto you, if ye have faith and doubt not, ye shall not only do this which is done to the fig tree, but also, if ye shall say unto this mountain, Be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, it shall be done. And all things whatsoever ye shall ask in prayer, believing ye shall receive." Now Luke doesn't give us the accounts of this particular cursing of the fig tree, but he does give us a parable that relates to the fig tree, in Luke chapter 13, verses 6 through 9. It says, "He spake also this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard. And he came and sought fruit thereon, and found none. Then said he unto the dresser of his vineyard, Behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and find none. Cut it down, why cumbereth it the ground? And he answering said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig around it and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well. And if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. So the scene opens here, very simply, with Jesus walking along a road with his disciples. He is traveling to the big city of Jerusalem from Bethany, a journey of only about 2 miles, but a journey that had to be made on foot. About halfway between Bethany and Jerusalem was a little village of Bethphage, which ironically enough means the house of unripe figs. So it was probably in this area, about halfway to Jerusalem, where Jesus saw this fig tree, seeing how this was a place that was famous for fig trees. And Jesus is hungry, and he sees the fig tree in the distance. As he approaches the fig tree, and he's hungry, obviously he approaches the fig tree with the expectation to satisfy his hunger. He sees leaves, but he sees no figs. Jesus curses the tree, and it dies. Why did Jesus do this? Why did he curse the fig tree? Jesus obviously had an expectation to satisfy his hunger. He saw leaves, but he sees no fruit. He curses the fig tree, and it dies. Notice that in Mark's account, it tells us that the time of figs was not yet. So there's been much controversy that has arisen over this verse, saying that this was out of character for Jesus, that he became angry at a fig tree when it wasn't the time of figs, that he had no right to be angry at this fig tree. And we need to examine why Jesus did this. Did he have a right to do what he did? And of course, we know that everything Jesus did had a purpose and that he had a right to do it. But we need to examine this and see why Jesus cursed this fig tree. One of the accusations is that Jesus allowed a fleshly desire, that is, that hunger, to create in him an unrighteous anger. Well, as Christians, we can be sure that Jesus didn't have an unrighteous anger. But there are those who have taken this, the occurrence of this, and said that Jesus could not be the Son of God because he became angry because he was hungry and he didn't find any fruit on this fig tree and it was not the time for figs. So there are people who have given great criticism to Jesus for this event. Was Jesus' anger justified? Or was it even anger for that matter? But if it was anger, was it justified? Did he have a right, in other words, to expect his hunger to be satisfied when he came to this fig tree? Well, I think this is a parable. Now, when I say a parable, you might think, wait a minute, this really happened. This is a story about something that really happened. And yes, it is. And I do believe that it actually happened. But I actually believe that it is a parable. Remember that a parable is when you take something common and readily understood by all of the people that you would be speaking to in order to teach an abstract lesson, in order to teach something else. And Jesus used that method of teaching all the time. Most of his teaching, I think, was probably a parable of one kind or another. Well, this is quite different than most of his parables because he would tell a parable. Sometimes he would say, here is a parable. Other times he didn't say, here is a parable. But he would just make a statement that was obvious and allusion to something else. And he would use it in that way to teach people using common things to teach uncommon lessons. This parable is different than that because Jesus doesn't anywhere indicate that it's a parable. It's not a parable of words. But I think it's an action parable. What Jesus did with the fig tree, he did to teach a different lesson. Not a lesson about fig trees, but another lesson. And that lesson is something that we can learn even today and help us. And that's the point of the lesson today, so that we can understand what Jesus was doing here and see why he did what he did in the lessons that he was trying to teach in doing this. I don't think Jesus was throwing a temper tantrum. I don't think he was overcome by hunger. We know that when he was tempted of Satan, he went 40 days without eating. So I don't think that he was so overcome with hunger here that he got mad at this fig tree. I believe we'll see there was a greater application for that. But how do we answer? And in order to answer why Jesus cursed the fig tree, I believe we need to put it in the context that this thing happens. Because I believe the context is of utmost importance in understanding what Jesus was doing with the cursing of the fig tree. Secondly, we're going to need to know something about fig trees. Understand that in this particular part of the country, everybody knew about fig trees. Today, living in Ohio and this part of the country, we know very little about fig trees. So when we read a parable about fig trees, or we see this about fig trees, we don't really understand all there is to know about fig trees. So you probably didn't come expecting to learn about fig trees today. But in order to really understand this, I think that there are a couple things about fig trees that we need to know. So after we learn about the setting, and after we learn a little bit about fig trees, we need to find out if there's any lessons that we can apply to us. And I believe there's three lessons that we can apply. So after we've shown the setting and shown about the fig trees, we're going to look quickly at three lessons that we can learn from Jesus' cursing of the fig tree. So let's begin by examining the setting of this dramatic event. Again, we'll say the setting as it begins to unfold is very simple. Jesus walking down a road from one town to another. But it's important for us to see the rest of the story. And we need to look at when did this happen. And again, I believe this is very significant to the events that unfold here, is the timing of them. This is Monday of Passover week. Jesus will die in 4 days. As they've traced history back, and historians have gone back on this time, and probably pretty accurately so, but the Bible doesn't tell us exactly the date, but this would be, from all of their accounts, very early in April, and they believe that Jesus probably was crucified on April 6th. That would make this April 2nd. To make it very early in April, nonetheless. And the day before this would have been Sunday, April 1st. What's significant about that is that's the day that Jesus, remember, he sent two apostles out to find the colt, and he brought the colt, and Jesus came in riding, and they were putting the palm leaves down in front of him, and it's known as his triumphant entrance into Jerusalem. So this was kind of a monumental occasion too. So we see a lot of things happening right at this time. Jesus' time is running short. He's going into Jerusalem, and I'm sure that he knew his purpose on earth was coming near to close, and that he knew his imminent crucifixion. So the timing is very important. So as we look at this, remember this is the last day of Jesus' life, the last week of Jesus' life. So what was going on at this particular time? What was happening in and around Jerusalem at this time? And we couldn't even begin to get in all the things that were happening at this time, because there was a lot of conflict between Jerusalem and the Roman authorities. There's conflict arising now between Jesus and Jerusalem, Jesus and the Romans, as he began to teach about him being a king and talking about a kingdom that he was going to establish. So he had everybody kind of shook up with that. They were seeing a rebellion, an uprising that would be threatening, if not at least to the leaders of Jerusalem, maybe even the Roman kingdom. So there's a big clash that's going on. particularly as the scriptures related to it, it's a great conflict that's coming about between Jesus and the leaders in Jerusalem. And it's the perfect storm, isn't it? I mean, all of this just coming to clash on numerous occasions. Recently, Jesus had rebuked the leaders in Jerusalem. He had very blatantly discussed their hypocrisy, their teaching of their traditions rather than the commandments of God. We need to look no further than Matthew chapter 23 to see the depth of that conflict, and we're not going to read all that, but that's the seven woes that Jesus placed upon the scribes and Pharisees. You'll remember seven different times in that chapter, he says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, ye hypocrites." And he begins talking about the actions, the things that they were engaged in that were not according to God's will, that they were violating God's will. And so many of the things that they were doing in their profession of godliness, in their occupations of relating God's will to man. So there was a lot going on in Jerusalem. They were beginning to kick back. They were beginning to recognize the threat that Jesus was making to them and their power because, as we saw in the text, the people were astounded by his teaching. And so they were starting to pay a lot of attention to Jesus. And if they started paying more attention to Jesus, no doubt the Jewish leaders felt really threatened by that. So it's a big conflict coming. And let's do look at Mark chapter 7, verses 6 through 9. I've not put all of these verses up on the PowerPoint, and I probably may go too fast for you to look them up, but hopefully not. Mark chapter 7, verses 6 through 9. He answered and said unto them, "Well hath Isaiah prophesied of you, hypocrites, as it is written, this people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrine the commandments of men. For laying aside the commandments of God, ye hold the traditions of men, as the washing of pots and cups, and many other such like things ye do." And he said unto them, "Full well ye reject the commandment of God, that ye may keep your own tradition." Well, this is a pretty strong rebuke, isn't it? And can you imagine being one of those Jewish leaders in those places of power and authority whose job it was to convey to the people God's commandments and having this accusation thrown to you? Not subtle, but very direct and very hard. So it is, in fact, the perfect storm that's coming about. And as a result of this, we see that there was a wicked plot underway. The scribes and Pharisees, Sadducees, all the leaders, from what we can see in the scriptures, had begun to conspire together, and as we saw in the text also, to destroy Jesus. They had a plot with trying to devise a plot that would allow them to successfully do away with Jesus. They had become very hard-hearted. They were, of course, more interested in keeping in place their traditions than even thinking about the coming of the Messiah, which was the whole point of their teaching, was to prepare the people for that. But the Pharisees and Sadducees had begun plotting how they might kill him. And, of course, as we've already mentioned, this plot will very shortly come to fruition as Jesus continues to provoke the leaders. In Mark chapter 12 and verse 12, just right over from the setting that we have here, it says, "They sought to lay hands on him, but feared the people, for they knew that he had spoken the parable against them, and they left him and went their way." This was the parable of the wicked tenants that he had just spoken. And the Pharisees and Sadducees realized that he was speaking against them, and they wanted to take him right then and do away with him. But they feared the people. So again, you can see that conflict. You can see that they were beginning to fear Jesus and fear the people who were following him, and they were beginning to envision a big uprising. And, of course, the Jewish leaders would be worried about that, because that would bring into play the Roman authorities. And it seems that the Romans were content for a long time to just let the Jews have their own little governing bodies and things, as long as they didn't step out of line. But of course, if there was an uprising like this, then that would bring the Roman authorities down on the leaders of the Jews. So this was a very scary time for them. And so they began to plot and scheme in a way that they could just take Jesus out of the picture. And Mark chapter 12 is that chapter of questions and conflict. And Jesus then starts speaking about the end of Jerusalem, the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. But in Mark chapter 13 and 2, he was telling them about the Jewish nation coming to an end and God's judgment being poured out upon this stubborn, fruitless, rebellious, and disobedient people. Look at Mark chapter 13 and look at the first two verses. "And as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. Jesus answering and said unto him, Seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." Jesus here, a direct prophecy regarding the coming destruction of Jerusalem. And what actually happened with that destruction of Jerusalem? Literally, there was not one stone left upon another. But the temple was summarily taken apart one stone at a time to harvest gold that was used in the mortar. So historical accounts show that the Romans came in and just took it apart one stone at a time, to where literally not one stone was left upon another. Well, Jesus began to talk about this, and that, of course, would have flared up that conflict to, we talk about taking it to the next level. That would have kind of taken it to the next level. So even more fear and determination by the Jewish leaders to get Jesus out of the way. And this conspiracy kind of moves the life of Jesus to its final stage. And they make this arrangement with Judas Iscariot to betray him in Mark chapter 14, verses 10 and 11. Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests to betray him unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad, and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him. So this perfect storm, this conflict, all of these things that were going on in and around Jerusalem were quickly coming to fruition here as Judas agreed to betray Jesus over to the authorities. And again, that set in motion the final events in the life of Jesus. Now, let's notice the layout of our text, because I think that's important too. We see the timing, we see the things that are going on in and around Jerusalem. Now let's look at the way the story is laid out. Particularly, we're looking at Mark's account, which is the thorough account. Matthew's account appears to be a summation of what Mark told us about. Mark tells this story in two parts. In verses 12 through 14, he tells about Jesus coming up on the fig tree and cursing it. And then on down in verses 20 through 22, it's when the disciples saw the fig tree and how it had withered away from the roots and were astonished at that, at how quickly it had faded away. Why does Mark tell the story in two parts? Well, I believe it's because it is, in nature, a parable. Because what happens between the telling of the event and the finishing up of that story with the disciples' realization of the withering of the fig tree? Sandwiched between those two events, talks about Jesus clearing the temple. Mark chapter 11, verses 15 through 18 in our text. And this is one of those final straws probably that was the Jewish leaders had just had more than they could take now, because Jesus went in to their sacred domain and he just cleaned it out and told them how they were being disobedient to God. And Jesus says it's supposed to be a house of prayer. You've made it a den of thieves. You see, there was no spirituality in these people. Their job was to be the spiritual leaders of the time, but they had no spirituality in what they were doing. They had no heart for God. Some people might say, well, look, they were the very men of God. They were the priests of God. They spent all day in the temple. These were holy men. But we can see by their actions that they were not spiritually minded. They were not trying to worship God as God wanted to be worshipped. They were holding to their traditions. They were making the temple a house of merchandise. They had an appearance of being godly, but they were not bringing forth the kind of fruit that God wanted. They were rebellious, and everything that they were doing seems to be contrary to what God would have them to do. They had an outward appearance, a show of spirituality. They promised much, but in fact, they had nothing in their hearts for God and what He wanted. So we see the big picture in the book of Mark. The time, 4 days till Jesus' death, the perfect storm, the rising conflict between Jesus and the Jewish leaders, and a conspiracy by those leaders to kill Jesus. And then we see with the layout of the text, the events of the cursing of the fig tree, sandwiched right in between that is Jesus' judgment on those in the temple, those buying and selling in the temple, his cleansing of the temple. So hold all those thoughts in mind as we learn a little bit about the fig tree. Because we need to understand some things about the fig tree in order to understand this without having conflict and apparent discrepancies that people have used to accuse Jesus. And as is always the case, the answer to this is not as difficult as it first appears when we read Luke's account. As with all apparent conflicts and difficult passages in the Bible, the problem is never with the Bible. It's always with us. It's always with a lack of our understanding. And once we have sufficient knowledge, we will understand that the text is right. And this is one of those instances, because one can do a few web searches and you can find out all you need to know about fig trees to understand more clearly the events that unfold here. In fact, you can look at the California Rare Fruit Growers website, www.crfg.com, and this tells us everything we need to know about the fig tree, because it's trying to teach people how to grow fig trees and all they need to know in this country to grow fig trees. And we can learn some things that everybody in that part of the country knew. Every fig farmer, everybody who ate figs, who knew about figs, who lived around figs, which was practically everybody, already understood the things that we don't really understand because we're not around fig trees. I've never seen a fig tree. I don't think I've ever even seen a fig. I've seen fig Newtons, but that's about the closest that I've ever come to seeing an actual fig. So I don't know very much about fig trees. So as I was researching these things, I learned a little bit about fig trees. The first thing, and the most surprising to me, is that the fig tree actually bears two different kinds of fruit every year. And I was kind of astonished to learn that. And that is a picture of a normal fig. That's the fig that is the one we hear about, the one that is sweet and tender, and it's the prized fig. That comes on later in the year, usually around June. So the 1st of April, it was not the time for figs, but it was the time for breva. And this is not a baby fig. It's a totally different fruit. It comes on only on the old stems. And if you can see closely, you can see how this is an older stem. The Bereba comes on first, right as the tree leaves. The Bereba come on the fig tree. And they only come on the old growth. And they never mature into a fruit like the fig. They are a small nut-like thing. It's not fruity. It's not tender. It cannot be substituted for a fig. That it's more like a nut. And they never, as I said, never grow to become a fig. So it's not an immature fig. And what usually happens is they simply fall off the tree a little bit later in the year. People who grow fig trees don't harvest the Bereba because it's not real good. The peasants used to pick them up and eat them because they had lack of other food to eat. So it was not a common delicacy or anything like that. It wasn't to be desired like the sweet fig, but it's important to understand that it was not a baby fig. It was a totally different thing. And actually, the Old Testament talks about this a few different times, and I just want to look at a couple of these because it's interesting that the prophecies that are made about the Bereba are prophecies dealing with judgment. And I think that, again, plays an important role in us understanding why Jesus cursed this fig tree. In Nahum chapter 3 and verse 12, it says, "All thy strongholds shall be like fig trees with the first striped figs. If they be shaken, they shall fall even into the mouth of the eater." So here we have a clear reference to that first striped fig, or the Bereba. And what's the application? That if the tree's shaken, they'll fall off, because it's not the real fig. And that's what ultimately happens to them anyways. They just fall to the ground. And he's pointing out that as they're rebellious to God, that's going to be the result of their strongholds. They'll be just shaken and they'll fall off the tree like the first striped figs. Also, Hosea 9 and verse 10. It says, "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first stripe in the fig tree at her first time. But they went to Baal-peor and separated themselves unto that shame, and their abominations were according as they loved." Then verse 16 goes on to talk about judgment being executed against them because of this. Again, the first stripe of the fig tree in her first time. So again, it's a clear allusion to the Bereba, the first fruit, the forerunner of the fig that comes on the tree in late March and early April. By contrast, the standard fig only grows on the new growth of the tree, the current year's shoots. And the Bereba's quality and quantity are both very substandard to that of the fig. It is both rich in quality and in quantity. It's sweet and juicy, luscious and tender, very different from the Bereba. The standard fig does not ripen for at least 6 to 8 weeks and up to 5 months after the Bereba. So, also very important to notice is that the Bereba is a forerunner of the fig, and it's an indicator of the crop of figs that is to come. In other words, if there is no Bereba, there will be no figs. So, of course, Jesus, being very familiar with a fig tree, would know that. All of those people around there would know that. We would not know that by just reading about a fig tree unless we read it somewhere or somebody told us about that. So it's my understanding that as Jesus came to this fig tree in early April, probably the 2nd of April, and he saw from a distance that it was leaved out, he had every right to expect that he could go to that tree, peel back the leaves, and there would be the Bereba. So he had every right to believe that he would find something to eat. And he was unable to find something to eat. So this makes the whole account make sense to us. And if we think about Jesus just going up to the fig tree when it wasn't the time for figs and cursing it, that doesn't seem fair, does it? It doesn't seem righteous. It doesn't seem consistent with the parable we read in Luke that says, no, let me dig around it and dung it and give it good care and give it one more year. And I think that ties in nicely to the judgment against Jerusalem that I believe is the object of this parable, because that's what happened with the Jews, isn't it? They were given one more chance because the gospel was sent first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles. So they were given that figurative one more year. But Jesus had every right to find something to eat on the tree. And Jesus destroys that tree because it had the leaves on it. It had the appearance of bringing forth fruit, but there was no fruit there. And that's the exact situation with the Jewish leaders. They had appearance. They had the leaves, but when you peel back the leaves, there was nothing there. And that's what brought the judgment about against Jerusalem. All the way in 70 AD, God's judgment against them when the temple was utterly destroyed, summarily dismantled, stone by stone. And I believe this is a forerunner of that judgment that would come upon Jerusalem. So Luke doesn't tell us that story, but I believe the parable of the fig tree that he gives us there contributes much to our understanding in this. It's talking about the judgment on Jerusalem. We see that in all of these accounts, tied right with the events going on in Jerusalem, in Mark, the cleansing of the temple, even sandwiched right in between the events, shows us that it's a parable about the judgment coming upon Jerusalem. So we've learned a little bit about the timing of this, the things that were going on in Jerusalem. We've learned a little bit about the fig tree. I hope you've learned a little bit about the fig tree. I sure did. I didn't know about the Bereva. I'd always wondered about that verse. I've even taught it in Bible study. I looked at it in 12 commentaries, and 10 of the 12 commentaries never even mentioned the Bereva. Most of them said, refer to our notes on Matthew. So they just addressed it in Matthew, where it didn't say it was not the season of figs. So it's opened the door for much accusations and unjust criticism of Jesus. So it's important for us to understand these things. So what can we learn? And I think there's probably always more than three lessons you could learn, but there's at least three important lessons we can learn from this. And we're just going to go through these quickly, as I think you'll see very clearly how they fit in with why Jesus cursed the fig tree. And we'll notice in Mark's account and Matthew's account how it's immediately followed by a lesson on faith. So I think first and foremost, we have a lesson in faith here. This ties in excellent with our Bible study this morning and with the apostles not understanding the feeding of the 5,000 and Jesus just performing miracle after miracle to try to open their eyes to understand. And so we see again a situation where this would open the eyes of the apostles, hopefully, and help them understand the importance of faith in their roles as disciples and apostles of Jesus. And help us even today to understand the active part that a strong faith plays in our Christian lives. As we saw the picture that he paints there of not only could you do this, not only could you curse this fig tree and it wither away, but if you have sufficient faith, you could even say to that mountain, be thou removed from this place and cast into the sea, and it would be so. So he was teaching them that, why are you astonished at the withering away of this fig tree? If you have faith, whatsoever you ask, it can be done. And I don't think that's necessarily a direct reference and a direct lesson to us today, but it is an important lesson to us today, because it does show us this, that without faith accompanying our prayers, we can expect to receive nothing. So our prayers should have faith. We should understand how important faith is in our lives as Christians. It's what keeps us from faltering. It's what allows us to overcome the trials and temptations that come about us on a daily basis. It's what gives us hope. Hope not only in this life, but hope in the life to come. Faith is of ultimate importance to us. And of course, we could go on a long time talking about faith. But I actually think that's just a small part of the point that Jesus was making here. It was almost an afterthought because of the apostles being astonished at what happened here. And so he uses it as an occasion to teach them about faith. I don't really think a point of him cursing the fig tree was to teach them about faith. I think a very important part, maybe the biggest part of Jesus cursing the fig tree, was a parable concerning the coming judgment. Not only the judgment against Jerusalem, but for us today, the coming judgment. It's important for us to understand that there is a judgment coming. The Jews needed to understand that they couldn't just go on doing whatever they wanted. They couldn't just go on teaching their traditions instead of the doctrines of God. This was a violation of God's commandment. And they couldn't continue with the blessing of God, doing that day in and day out, having the appearance of righteousness, but inwardly having none. They couldn't go on doing this way. Judgment would come. And sure enough, about 40 years after the telling of this, the judgment came upon Jerusalem. And it was summarily destroyed, as we've already said. Well, there is a coming judgment. And it's important for us to understand that, just as it was important for the Jews to understand it at that time. In Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27, a verse that's very familiar to us, it's appointed unto man once to die, and after that, the judgment. The judgment is unavoidable. It's an appointment that we all will keep. And we need to understand that, because we need to adjust our lives day by day, because we understand that that judgment is coming. That's what the Jews didn't do. They didn't understand. They didn't make the connection that as they drifted further and further away from God's law, they were facing a coming judgment. In their case, it was a physical judgment and a judgment yet to come. But specifically, it was a physical judgment from him. And it's amazing that they couldn't see this, because time and again in the Old Testament, we see how they would wander away from God. They would begin following idols, and judgment would come upon them. Time and again, wasn't it? And yet, they couldn't see the judgment coming. And what did they do when they were told about the coming judgment? They got mad at the person telling them, and they wound up killing their Savior, or at least attributing to the killing of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10. Again, a very important verse for us regarding the judgment. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that which he has done, whether it be good or bad. So just as the Jews face the judgment, we face the judgment. We will give account of all that we've done in our body, be it good or bad. And that's why the plan that Jesus has given us to allow us to be forgiven of those sins is so important. But I believe that Jesus' cursing of the fig tree was showing that. It was showing the coming judgment. It was showing that you can't have the appearance of bearing fruit and not bear fruit. I don't believe it was because Jesus was mad at the tree for not having fruit on it. Remember, this was the land of unripe figs. He could have went somewhere real close and probably found another fig tree, and it probably would have had the breba on it. So it wasn't anger. It wasn't the fact that he was so hungry he couldn't make it all the way to Jerusalem. It was because the tree had the appearance of bringing forth fruit, but it had none. And Christ judged it for that. Same way, he was trying to teach Jerusalem that judgment is coming. He was trying to make his apostles understand that judgment is coming. And that brings us to the final thought. Important lesson. And the one that you probably thought of before we even started the lesson. Why did Jesus curse the fig tree? He cursed the fig tree because it was unfruitful. And that part is true. The fig tree was unfruitful. It was not the season for figs. But if you notice in the text, in verse 13, seeing a fig tree far off having leaves, he came, if haply he might find anything thereon. I think it's significant that it doesn't say to see if he could find any figs on it, because the time of figs was not yet. He didn't go to the tree expecting to find figs. He went to the tree expecting to find breva, and he found none. He knew, of course, being familiar with fig trees, that if this tree didn't produce any breva, it was not going to produce any figs later in the year. Well, the Bible is full of examples about bearing fruit. We'll just look at a couple of them quickly. Again, in a parable-type language in John chapter 15, the first 8 verses, it says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit, for without me ye can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered, and men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. Herein is my Father glorified, that ye bear much fruit. So shall ye be my disciples. Doesn't this just fit right in with the idea of the cursing of the fig tree? Because it didn't have any breva on it, and he knew that it wasn't going to bear forth fruit, so it was worthless. Our relationship with Jesus is meant to be life-changing and fruit-bearing. Galatians chapter 5, verses 21 through 24, talk about the fruit of the Spirit. We'll just look at verse 22. It says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, on into verse 23, meekness, and temperance. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. There's so many more references to fruit-bearing. We won't look at all them, but Matthew chapter 7, verses 17 through 19, Mark chapter 4 and verse 20, Romans 6, 22, Romans 7 and 4, Hebrews 13 and 15 all talk about bearing fruit, and I'm sure that's a partial list because the Bible is full of admonitions for us as Christians that we need to be bearing fruit for God. Let's look at that one reference in Romans chapter 7, verses 4 and 5. Says, wherefore, my brethren, ye also are become dead to the law by the body of Christ, that ye should be married to another, even to him who is raised from the dead, that we should bring forth fruit unto God. For when we were in the flesh, the motions of sins, which were by the law, did work in our members to bring forth fruit unto death. So we see here about two kinds of fruit, a fruit that's unto death, and of course a fruit unto God. Fruit unto eternal life. We need to bring forth fruit unto God. That's our job as Christians. That's what we're here for, is to bring forth fruit. Just like the fig tree is there to bring forth fruit. A fig tree that doesn't bring forth fruit is useless. a Christian who doesn't bring forth fruit is useless. So we need to bring forth fruit. And I think that is an important lesson that we can get regarding why Jesus cursed the fig tree. Let's look quickly in conclusion. The lesson, of course, isn't about a fig tree or about a fig or even about a breva. But it's about, first and foremost, the fruitless Jewish nation. It's about faith and about the coming judgment. God destroyed Jerusalem because they had an outward appearance of being fruitful, but inwardly they were bringing forth only fruit to their own desires, their own lusts, their own traditions. And that was not pleasing in the sight of God. That wasn't fruit unto God. The lesson for us is that we need to have more than just an appearance of righteousness. That means we need to do more than just come a couple times a week and worship God. We need to bring forth fruit daily. We need to always live according to the will of God. Anyone can look good on Sunday morning, but that alone is not a good test of faithful Christian living. The Jews, from all outward appearance, the Jewish leaders, appeared to be righteous, appeared to be God-fearing and God-serving people. But their heart was far from God. He said, "In vain you worship me, because you teach for doctrines the commandments of men." The question before us is, when Jesus approaches us and peels back the leaves, what will he find? Will he find that we're bringing forth fruit? Or will he find that we're like the fig tree, worthy of cursing and not blessing? We need to live every day bringing forth fruit in the kingdom of God, that he might look upon us and be pleased, and we might have his blessing to help us as we go through this life. I hope that this has been helpful to you and interesting. I thought it was a very fascinating lesson. I hope that it helped as we think about our purpose as Christians here and our need to bring forth fruit for him and an understanding of the coming judgment, because that's what we do need to fear. And I think everyone here is Christians, and we know that God has given us a simple plan to salvation. We've all been obedient to that, to hear and believe his word, to repent, to change our will to do his, to confess him publicly. We believe him to be the Son of God, to be buried with him in baptism, to rise and walk in new life, and to be faithful unto death, that we might call heaven our home when this life is over. But if somewhere along the line you've fallen short of that, or you would just like to make known something in your life, or ask the prayers of the congregation, whatever the case may be, won't you come while together we stand and sing the song that's been selected.